Utah was the first state to enact a law requiring women to wait 72 hours and make 2 clinic visits before having an abortion. Sarah Roberts, professor of reproductive sciences at University of California, San Francisco, studied Utah's law. She says she wanted to understand how these laws affect women.
The 72-hour waiting period and 2-visit requirement caused hardships for women, most of whom had already made their decision by the time they presented for care. As most were not conflicted in their decision about whether to have an abortion when they sought abortion care, the 72-hour waiting period requirement seems unnecessary.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, academic researchers examine the laws, policies, and cultural practices embedded in Utah and American society in general that's contributing to gender inequality. That's all coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing the first of 2 panel discussions recorded recently on the topic of inequality. Today's discussion focuses on gender inequality. 4 academics, 3 from the University of Utah and 1 from the University of California, San Francisco, gathered to examine what gender inequality means, what causes it, why it's a problem, and what can be done about it. Our first speaker is Professor Gunsli Barak. She's a professor of economics at the University of Utah, and she researches and teaches development economics and feminist economics. She spoke about her research into the so-called gender wage gap, essentially why, in general, men still make more money than women in the U.S.
I will start with the conversation starter statistic. And this year, it's the gender wage ratio of 78.6%. And of course, the counterpart of that is a gender wage gap of 21.4%. And that essentially refers to median annual earnings of women who work full-time year-round compared to their male counterparts. And by that measure, actually, women have made considerable progress, or substantial progress, over the last several decades. And that is visible in this figure, where the middle trend shows the gender wage gap rising, or gender wage ratio rising over time, and from a point where in 1980 it was 60%, and now in 2014 it is 78.6%. So that represents substantial progress, and of course that reflects the outcome of the trends in men's earnings and the trends in women's earnings. So the blue line on top, trend on top, of course, shows that men's earnings have been fairly stagnant over this period of time. Note that these figures are adjusted for inflation, so they actually control for that effect. And it shows that essentially men have not been doing very well over this 1980-2014 period in terms of their earnings. And yet, women, starting from a much lower base, have experienced an increase in their earnings. That too has stalled in the 2000s, but there has been a substantial increase until then. And now, to just give a quick backstory of what went on that accounts for that rise in women's median earnings, and these are, of course, full-time, year-round employed women that we're looking at. So there's a relative homogeneity in terms of the two groups that we are comparing here. And, the backstory, of course, is the anti-discrimination laws in terms of employment and education, Title VII, Title IX, in the 60s and the 70s, and also the government requiring contractors that do business for the government's business to make good faith efforts to diversify their workforce otherwise known as affirmative action efforts. And these efforts sort of started to work themselves through the 70s. And by the time we get to the 80s, we actually see some of these results in the form of a rise in educational qualifications of women, and to the point where now actually women have reversed the gender wage gap. A higher share of women hold advanced degrees compared to men, and their years of schooling have also surpassed men. And their work experience the gap between men and women has substantially narrowed from 7 years to 1.4 years, and the occupational segregation has diminished substantially as women made inroads into managerial occupations, specifically sort of male-dominated professional occupations, and they have reduced their share in the lower-paying administrative support, secretarial types of occupations. So this is the backstory of, you know, explaining this rise in the earnings ratio, but it has stalled at the same time that the occupational segregation is no longer diminishing, and labor force participation of women is actually declining. So that's sort of the trends story. Now, economists' approach to this to understanding the gender wage gap essentially tries to parse out and break down the wage gap, that 21.4% figure, for example, into its components and say, well, to what extent are we looking at, you know, lower qualifications of women or the types of jobs they're working in, and to what extent we're looking at differential pay on account of just gender and for the same characteristics. So these are called the explained and the unexplained. And just in time for this panel, Francine Blau and Larry Kahn, who are Cornell economists, have released their latest installment of their examination of the gender wage gap, and they've deployed this methodology that I've mentioned, you know, parsing out or splitting the gender wage gap into its components. And here we have policy implications can grow out of this picture and out of this analysis. And what we see essentially is lower qualifications of women relative to men accounted for about a quarter of the gender wage gap in 1980. By 2010, only 8%. And in fact, the education gap is actually working to reduce the gender wage gap. And it's sort of down to only the work experience differential at this point in terms of the qualifications. On the other hand, very strikingly, employment location of men and women actually has substantially increased its explanatory or contributory power to the gender wage gap, and now it accounts for half of the gender wage gap. That means women's employment in lower paying occupations, in particular, but also industries, explains a substantial or more substantial, quantitatively speaking, share of the gender wage gap. So, and then final takeaway that I'll highlight is the total unexplained, and that's the differential pay for essentially same characteristics, just on account of gender. And that has diminished, but it's still 38% of the gender wage gap. So how do we interpret this unexplained? Well, either there's something that is relevant that is unmeasured. You know, we have omitted variables that, you know, could explain that large 38%. Or, I think it's both, there is possibly employer bias against women, and it doesn't have to be, you know, overt or intended, but, you know, can be subtle, and that is at work.
That was Gunsali Barak. She's a professor of economics at the University of Utah. She spoke about the gender wage gap and what accounts for why, in general, across many different sectors of the economy, women still make significantly less money than men. If you're just tuning in this morning, today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, we're airing talks from a recent panel examining gender inequality in America. Our next speaker is Sharon Mastracci, associate professor at the University of Utah and a fellow at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She studies women and gender in public service organizations, and she speaks about her research on the importance that women's representation and economic participation are to women's equality overall. She also offers some policy recommendations, and later she shares some thoughts on the potential roles and care work to explain the gender wage gap.
The most recent gender gap report by the World Economic Forum, released late last year, finds that women's pay in relation to men's has not budged since the start of the global economic crisis in 2008. Women's pay is roughly equal to what men earned on average in 2006, which is to say women's pay is about a decade behind men's. In her discussion of the latest global gender gap report, Juliet Jowett of The Guardian notes that at current rates of change, it will take 118 years for women around the world to earn equal pay to men. Sorry. That's all I got. Actually, I've got more. Which factors matter most to a country's gender gap index? I find that both women's political participation and economic policy changes have the greatest impact on this index. But before I get into the details, let me first note that the gender gap report includes more than just pay inequality in its index. From the WEF report, the Global Gender Gap Index was developed in 2006 partially to address the need for a consistent and comprehensive measure for gender equality that can track a country's progress over time. What they do is they convert more than a dozen individual country indicators into ratios between women and men in four categories: economic participation, educational attainment, health, and political empowerment. Now, the 118-year prediction refers to averages worldwide. And we know from analyses of the gender pay gap in the United States that the 77 cents on the dollar statistic doesn't compare women and men doing identical work. And indeed, I will revisit this observation that women and men do different kinds of jobs later when I briefly discuss care work and emotional labor. The gender pay gap in the United States, as we've already heard, is the product of several factors, such as occupational differences. Women and men hold different jobs, differences in hours, and differing levels of educational attainment and years of experience. But these differences, rather than being choices, as we've already heard, these differences are largely rooted in women's greater caregiving roles and not due to those deliberate choices to work in lower-paying industries or work part-time or take time away from paid employment. In their latest study, Fran Blau and Larry Kahn, as we've heard, find that fully 62% of the gender wage gap is attributable to the structural and social factors that drive the decisions women make about where and how long they work. Of course, that leaves fully 40% of unexplained, which makes paycheck fairness and direct discrimination still relevant for policymakers. Now, policy solutions to address the gender pay gap underscore the importance of supporting women to reconcile the demands of work and caregiving that they face. And such policy solutions include increasing federal child care subsidies, passing paid sick leave policies, and passing a national paid family and medical leave insurance program. The Center for American Progress notes that the United States is one of only a few countries in the world, and certainly the only advanced economy, where mothers do not have the right to paid maternity leave after the birth of a child. Now, returning to the 2015 World Economic Forum report, it is true that the United States is among the minority of countries that do not offer any kind of government-paid maternity leave. In fact, one-third of the 135 countries profiled in the 2015 report provide at least 2 months of paid maternity leave at 100% pay, and just under half of the 135 countries provide at least 2 months of paid maternity leave at least half pay. These countries include some of the likely candidates, like France, Finland, and Denmark, but also some interesting surprises like Poland, Chile, Lithuania, Vietnam, Senegal, and Israel. Another unfavorable country comparison for the United States relates to political representation. While only 19% of Congress is composed of women, other countries have much greater representation in their parliaments, in ministerial-level positions, as heads of states, and in public administration. Proportions of women in parliaments in Nicaragua and New Zealand, for instance, are 41 and 31%, respectively. Rwanda is ranked first globally on this measure and is only one of two countries, including Bolivia, worldwide, that have more women in men than in their parliament than men. Proportions of women in parliaments in Canada, the UK, and Australia also exceed the proportion of the US. Now, to tease out the effects of the different policies on a country's level of gender inequality, I recently analyzed World Economic Forum data over time to see which had the greatest impact on a country's global gender gap index. And I find that the five most influential factors explaining the variation in the index in this order are the proportion of women holding seats in parliament, the number of years that a country's had a female head of state, purchasing power parity between women and men, in other words, closing that gender pay gap, the proportion of ministerial level positions held by women, and the percent of women in public administration. Policies targeting political empowerment and economic participation provide the most promise because, as World Economic Forum notes, on average, over 96% of the gap in health outcomes and 95% of the gap in educational attainment outcomes have already been closed. In other words, gender equity has largely been achieved in health and education, but much more needs to be done in the areas of economic opportunity and political participation. Now, some scholars are critical of quota systems that function mostly on paper, as has been seen in some South American countries. The effectiveness of the gender quota legislation can be undermined by cultural and institutional factors, so quotas must be accompanied by broader reforms, including enforcement and accountability, with sanctions for noncompliance and cultural and institutional changes accepting women in leadership positions, and, of course, work-life balance programs to foster gender equality in both political empowerment and workplaces overall. Despite these criticisms, however, many scholars still note the importance of quota laws as at least a step in the right direction. And I quote Drew Dollar up here, who says, "Unless one sees quotas as counterproductive to gender equality, there is no reason not to demand a reform that seems at present possible to carry out even in male-dominated parliaments. A strong, autonomous movement is needed in order to make it possible for the elected women to influence parties and national agendas." So in sum, my analysis of several years' worth of WEF data reveals that the importance of increasing women's political representation to mitigating inequality between women and men. These steps would also address the other key factor in closing WEF's broad gender gap measure, and that's economic inequality. Because more women in political and administrative positions bring about the policies that reflect the will of all people. That is the predictions of representative bureaucracy theory, and it has been borne out in a number of studies. So in addition to enacting policies to support women's caregiving roles in families to allow them to reconcile work and family demands and increasing women's political participation, policy scholars also underscore the importance of specific employment policy changes to closing equality gaps between women and men. A different report by the Center for American Progress recommends raising both the minimum wage and the tipped minimum wage because women, as we've already heard, comprise a disproportionate share of low-wage workers. The Economic Policy Institute notes that women make up two-thirds of tipped workers and are 70% of food servers and bartenders. In their 2015 report, the Commission on Inclusive Prosperity, which was co-chaired by Larry Summers, they go further to note, not only recommend increasing the minimum wage, but to also index that minimum wage on the Consumer Price Index to avoid purchasing power erosion, as well as to take the politics out of minimum wage policy. What's more, older women rely on Social Security more than older men do in retirement, underscoring the need to preserve the financial viability of this income security program as well. So mitigating economic and political gaps between women and men not only benefits women, but also mitigates economic inequality overall. Maria Concian and Deborah Reed from a 2006 paper find that women's earnings in dual-income households reduced income inequality overall because the income distributions across households would have been more unequal without their earnings. And Brendan Duke's more recent finding extends that study and further confirms it. And finally, Paul Krugman and Robin Wells note the intergenerational effects of income inequality in that children's socioeconomic status as adults is greatly influenced by parents' earnings. In my final remarks, I return to a continuing program of research with which I've been engaged with longtime collaborators for most of my academic career, and that's the study of emotional labor. Initial research by my colleagues Mary Guy and Meredith Newman attempted to explain the gender gap by teasing out unpaid emotional labor. Turns out the reality is a lot more complex than this, in that both women and men engage in emotional labor, although they do different types of work. And it's that different types of work that we have turned to more recently. This introduces the topic of care work and valuing care work. Now, Paula England has long observed, in a variety of contexts, that women's work is undervalued, and indeed, we too find care work to be taken for granted. But whether it actually explains the gender pay gap remains an open question. In sum, what we do know is this. Straightforward policy proposals to allow women to reconcile their work and family roles can go a long way to mitigate economic inequality between women and men. Mitigating economic inequality between women and men also reduces income inequality overall, and the intergenerational impact of economic inequality underscores the importance of doing so. Increasing the numbers of women in elected and appointed positions, as well as in administration, further promotes gender equality and can help get the aforementioned work-family reconciliation policies and proposals passed and implemented. And I am personally engaged in research on several fronts related to these issues, and we don't need to wait 118 years for that to happen. Thank you.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Sharon Mastracci is an associate professor at the University of Utah and a fellow at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She studies women and gender in public service organizations, and she spoke about her research on the importance of women's representation and economic participation to women's equality overall. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, of course, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service to you. Today, we're airing a series of talks given as part of a forum on gender inequality. This forum was recorded on March 31st. Our next speaker traveled from the University of California, San Francisco to give her talk. Sarah Roberts is an assistant professor in the Department of Reproductive Sciences at UCSF, and she's an assistant professor at the School of Medicine. Roberts researches policies that affect women's reproductive lives, including state-level abortion restrictions and child protective services policies around alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. She is interested in developing what she calls a genuine public health approach to abortion facility standards. Professor Roberts spoke about her research of women's experiences with Utah's 72-hour waiting period to have an abortion.
I would like to acknowledge my co-authors on this study that actually came out just this past week, as well as thank Tabitha and Jim for inviting me here to talk about this here in Utah. So I want to start by providing a little bit of background information about abortion. I am in a medical school, and so I don't usually talk to large groups of social scientists. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page about some basic information about abortion. Abortion in the U.S. is common. About half of pregnancies in the United States are unintended, and about 40% of unintended pregnancies end in abortion. This means that about one out of every five pregnancies ends in abortion. So abortion is common. One in 10 women will have an abortion by age 20, one in four by age 30, and three in 10 by age 45. In addition to abortion being common, state regulations of abortion are common. 33 states restrict the use of Medicaid funding to pay for abortion. 38 states require parental involvement for a minor to have an abortion. And 28 states have a waiting period that require women seeking abortion to wait a specified amount of time between receiving information about abortion and then having an abortion, most typically 24 hours. There's been some research about these abortion restrictions. These three restrictions have been in place in some states for almost 40 years, so there's been ample opportunity to do some research about them. The most clear research findings about the effects of the restrictions relate to public funding restrictions, and the best estimates suggest that about one-fourth of women who would have had their abortion paid for by Medicaid instead give birth when that funding is unavailable. In terms of parental involvement laws, what has been found, there's been quite a bit of research as well, is that they increase the number of minors who travel out of state for abortion. But even though there's been quite a bit of research, the research is really unclear about whether or not the laws have an impact on abortion and pregnancy rates. There's been a smaller amount of research about the effects of waiting periods. When it's just a waiting period without requiring women to make two visits to the clinic, so when women can get the information by phone or by mail, that hasn't been found to have an effect on abortion or pregnancy rates. But a two-visit requirement requiring women to make two visits to an abortion facility is associated with a decrease in the abortion rate in the state, an increase in the number of women traveling out of state for an abortion, and an increase in the number of abortions in the second trimester. But what I want to point out is that all of this research was done in a very different context in terms of state laws about abortion. So we are not in that context anymore. It is completely different. And I am not going to focus on all of the different aspects, but I want to highlight a few for people to note. First, the number of state-level abortion restrictions in the U.S. Has increased dramatically. Between 2011 and 2013, there were more state-level abortion restrictions enacted than in the entire previous decade. And so in addition to the number, you see one type of restriction layered upon another and another and another. So you have multiple restrictions in place at the same time. We also have a changing geographic landscape. And so as I mentioned before, in relation to parental involvement laws and waiting period laws, women have historically gone to a neighboring state that did not have one of those laws in order to have an abortion. But as more and more states enact these laws, those local escape valves, as I call them, no longer exist, and we don't know what the implications of that are. And then finally, we're seeing something that I call lengthening and strengthening of the laws. So in terms of parental involvement laws, they're moving from laws that require minors to notify one parent before having an abortion to laws that require minors to obtain parental consent from two parents before having an abortion. And in terms of waiting periods, we're seeing a second visit added on. So those that didn't require two visits are now having two visits. And also we're seeing them lengthen from 24 hours to 48 hours and 72 hours. So Utah was the first state to pass a 72-hour waiting period, or not pass, actually, to enact a 72-hour waiting period for abortion. This law went into effect in May 2012, and it does require women to attend two visits. We wanted to understand what women's experiences were with a 72-hour waiting period law and a two-visit requirement. And in particular, we were really interested in the reasons that women who don't have an abortion after seeking one under this law, why don't they have an abortion? What are their reasons? And then how do these requirements, both the waiting period and the two-visit requirement, affect women? So we worked with four family planning facilities in Utah that do the first required abortion information visit. And they recruited women who were presenting for that visit and had them complete a self-administered iPad survey. And then we followed up with them by telephone 3 weeks later. So one of the things that we measured, and I'm emphasizing this here because it's one of the things that we actually found was associated with whether or not women had had an abortion when we followed up with them, is how conflicted they were about their decision when they presented for care. And we used two different measures to assess decisional conflict or decisional certainty, or whether women had fully made their decision or were still in the process of making their decision when they presented for care. We used one that's been used in a range of different healthcare settings, and then we used another one that has been used in terms of abortion counseling. It's a scale that's been used in terms of assessing women's certainty in terms of counseling in abortion. We found that they actually performed really similarly in our models, and so we're focusing on the one that's used more broadly in healthcare. And so what we found was that overall, the vast majority of women had made their decision by the time they presented at the abortion information visit. 71% reported low conflict, 21% reported medium conflict, and there were 8% who reported high conflict. And this 8% is at the level where in other healthcare settings, this would be of clinical concern in relation to wanting to make sure to provide some additional counseling to somebody to help them make their decision about what they were going to do. So we're talking about 8% here. When we followed up with them 3 weeks later, we found that 86% of them had had an abortion, 3% had had a miscarriage, 2% were still seeking an abortion, one woman was still deciding, 8% were no longer seeking an abortion, and one woman had been unable to have her abortion because the waiting period pushed her beyond the facility's gestational limit for providing abortions. And I didn't mention our sample size. We had 500 women in the study, and that was 3/4 of the women that we recruited ended up participating. And then when we followed up, we had 2/3 of the women complete the follow-up. So here's our regression output, and I highlight the predictors that are statistically significant in red. Hopefully you can see it. The two that were statistically significant were the gestational age that women discovered their pregnancy and how conflicted they were about their decision when they first presented for care. And I'll show you the decisional conflict again in another slide. It looks like it's a really small effect, but that's because it's a 100-point scale. So it doesn't look like there's a big effect, but in fact, that's the increase in the odds for each 1-point increase on that scale. Looking at this in another way, what we see is that the overwhelming majority of women who had low or medium conflict when they presented for care went on to have an abortion. Only a small minority did not. Among the 8% who reported high conflict, about half of them went on to have an abortion and half did not. So to tell you what to take from that for a moment, the vast majority of women had made their decision by the time they presented for care and went on to implement the decision. The few who didn't have an abortion, most of that was because they had been conflicted to begin with. When we asked women their reasons for not having an abortion, of the 34 who had not had an abortion when we followed up with them, the most common reason women offered was that they just couldn't do it. Financial reasons, other people coming through for them, and being too far along in their pregnancy. And I want to show you a little bit about what that looks like using women's own words. It was a hard decision for me to make in the first place, and once I made the appointment, it kind of hit home. About 2 days after the information appointment, I canceled the abortion appointment. I couldn't do it. It's something I've always been against. I had my reasons I thought were good reasons, and then I re-reasoned myself out of it. I get paid every week, but every time I think I have enough money, it all gets taken out in taxes. So I'm just under the amount I need. Every time I try to make an appointment, something else comes up that I have to pay. And my boyfriend got his shit together. Had I not had to do the first appointment, I would have been able to have the abortion earlier. But because I had to wait so long to schedule the first appointment, by the time I was able to gather funds, get childcare, and find a way to get to the second appointment, I was 13 weeks, and I wasn't comfortable getting the abortion anymore. In terms of cost to women, even though the law requires a 72-hour wait, in fact, what we found was that women, on average, waited 8 days between their abortion information visit and having the abortion. We found that in order to make the arrangements, the logistical arrangements to go to the first visit, a small proportion, 6%, had to disclose that they were seeking abortion to somebody else. And we found that having to make that first visit increased the cost of the abortion by 10%. And I didn't emphasize this earlier, but the vast majority, or actually not the vast majority, about 1/3 of women were on public assistance, and the median household income for the past year was $22,000. So increasing the cost of abortion by 10% is not a negligible cost. We also asked women to tell us in their own words what the hardest parts about the law was. One woman said, "I had to wait like a week and a half. That was killing me. I'm a person who wants to get everything over and done with once I've made a decision, so that was hard. I wanted it over and done with to move on with my life. Just the stress of how the procedure is going to go, because you just want to get it over with. I couldn't sleep for 3 nights." So that's on the emotional side, and here's on the financial and logistical side. "I knew the longer it took, the more money it would cost. We're living paycheck to paycheck as it is. And if I had gone 1 week sooner, it would have been $100 less. Financially, it was just hard. It's hard to take time away from things I could be doing. It made it inconvenient. I could have stayed in Utah in between, but I have 3 children, so I couldn't stay there. I had to make the trip, come back home, and do the regular stuff, and then plan another trip. So in conclusion, the 72-hour waiting period and 2-visit requirement caused hardships for women, most of whom had already made their decision by the time they presented for care. As most were not conflicted in their decision about whether to have an abortion when they sought abortion care, the 72-hour waiting period requirement seems unnecessary. Individualized patient counseling, like is done in other areas of healthcare and is routinely provided in most abortion settings, seems more appropriate for the small minority of women who were conflicted when they presented for care, rather than using a blunt policy instrument that affects everybody. This is by no means my work alone. There's an entire team in California who worked on this, as well as some amazing collaborators here in Utah. Thank you.
That was Sarah Roberts. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Reproductive Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. She spoke about her research of women's experiences with Utah's required 72-hour waiting period to have an abortion. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in just a moment. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing the first of 2 panel discussions held recently on the topic of inequality. Today's discussion focuses on gender inequality. 4 academics, 3 from the University of Utah and 1 from the University of California, San Francisco, gathered to examine what gender inequality means, what causes it, why it's a problem, and what can be done about it. Speaking next is Teresa Molina. She's an assistant professor at the University of Utah's College of Social Work, and she is associate director of the university's Neighborhood Partners Program. She spoke about how gender inequality affects different ethnic groups in Utah, also immigrants, and how it affects Utah's changing demographics overall.
We have grown in the number of diverse populations, being Latinos the majority, and then the refugee background populations. So we are talking a lot about women who are first-generation immigrants in our valley. And as such, they come with different cultural values. They have they are used to different gender roles than the mainstream society. And for that sake, they have a hard time to go into the workforce. They just don't have the skills, don't have the language, don't have the cultural views of entering the workforce. And they are challenged with things like learning how to drive, learning how to speak the language, and a lot of work at home with children. Because in many aspects, the motherhood piece is still a high value for them. It's not this general view of I'm gonna get my education, I'm gonna go and settle myself with a good job, and then I'll think about marrying, or I'll think about having children, or by the time the reproductive age is gone, it's just we didn't become mothers or things like that. For them, it's another universe, another reality, whether married or not. We have situations with women of not the dominant religion locally who are just to have a child after another child, and by the time they've been living here 5 to 10 years, they are mothers of 4, 5, or 6 children. So their work is taking care of the children. And for that sake, they depend a lot on social support. I have the opportunity to interact on one-on-one with them. It's not that they are not adjusting. Like at this time, I have in my mind a case in which she's a mother of 5 and she's taking a social work case management certificate here at the University of Utah. So we're talking about a woman who is trying to move ahead and is valuing education. And she is asking, does the system want us to live all the time in poverty? Because now I'm a single mother, and if I make a little more from the poverty threshold, I lose Medicaid for my children. So am I educating? This is her questions. I mean, I'm maybe paraphrasing, but she asked me, so does the system want us to be poor all the time? So that question really shocked me, right? Because what should I tell her? No, you should go ahead, keep working, and earn more, so you lose Medicaid when the cost of health in this country. So and it happens that we are talking also about people of color. We are not talking about, generally speaking, Caucasian white people, right? We're talking about people of color. So many compounding factors beyond the gender are happening here. Also, women from not dominant religions, so I'm not only talking about the LDS church locally, but any Judeo-Christian religion. I'm talking about the Islam and Muslim women. They are used to wait for males' decisions in many aspects. And I would hate to stereotype, and we know it's very hard to do that. But we are having immigrants here coming with refugee status who bring their wife and, some way or another, their girlfriends made it here. So those are becoming single parents. So now we're talking about women who are single parents and who come with a very different cultural view. And the relevance that I see is this is what is happening locally. This is what is happening in our backyard. These are the things that, socially speaking, we need to think about, those politics and those integration structures that we can create. That's such an initiative I'm part of, University Neighborhood Partners. And it's good that it's an initiative from the University of Utah president. Very nice. Because the university represents power. The university represents connection, the possibility of advocating, the possibility of not making these people invisible, such as it is hundreds of undocumented mothers who, after losing their livelihoods, given to all the economic realities of mostly Latin American countries and mostly Central American countries and Mexico, had to come here at middle ages with their kids. They are those women doing housekeeping, probably at some of our houses, women who are doing hair care, and who are raising 2, 3, 4 children who may be born here or who might be brought with them as minors. So the Utah has been impacted by how we see DACA, the deferred action on children brought in infancy, and DAPA, the parental responsibility, and how we are going to make decisions on that, or the Supreme Court, for the same sake, right? We know that there is a long, I would say even human skill to blame on the victims. to say that it's their choices, to believe that things are a matter of choices when people haven't had the opportunities. And it is in the best of interest of all these macroeconomic measures and changes, that's my perspective, to change those odds for those children, for those women, for those people our own children are going to be interacting with, maybe marrying in the second, third generation, and then we change our views. Because all of a sudden, it's not my family matter, but it's really true that my family is embedded in a society in which if I don't care for my neighbor, my backyard is not going to be the nicest. So what we do at UMP is working for that new generation. Encouraging those kids to use the tools that could help them make a intergenerational change. To be they the ones who go to school. To be the ones who change their minds. It's very difficult. It is creating, as in all these populations, a lot of conflict between especially younger girls who have new influences, who don't want to follow who their family traditions, but who are posed in conflict because of this need. And how or what policies locally need to change in order to address these needs. Many of the ones that have been already mentioned. So I just want to highlight that having all this background in our minds should not take us away from the individual woman predicament who haven't followed the path of working, but who has had this influence to the point that her life will be consumed in all these moral and social conflicts because we were not clear enough about her individual rights to make decisions. And that is talking about abortion, and that is talking about wages, and that is talking about education. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to open it up for questions now, and I would ask that if you have a question, you wait for the microphone and do not make the same mistake that I did when I started.
Thank you. In addition to that, please just provide your name when you ask your question.
Hi, I'm Tabitha Benny. Thank you. This was an awesome panel, way better than I honestly expected. Such interesting variations of these topics and how they interrelate to each other is something I never really sort of thought through before. So I was just curious if each of you could sort of, you know, if you could summarize or if you could think of, you know, the one way in particular women could act to get represented more. In some way you all sort of touch on this this lack of representation for women. And I'm curious, in your area, what would enable women to have that sort of ability to make their own decisions, as Teresa just said so well?
I'm going to answer again from the microcosmos. I think that the building skills, a lot of paraprofessional opportunities is important. It is true that at the microcosmos, the family, the household, making an earning, having an income changes the dynamics at the home. And of course, we would like to see more, not only with the same skills, the same pay, gender-wise. I talk a lot from what I think, even though I'm an academic. I would agree more with this Australian feminist economist, Whitley, what's her name? Wary. Who says equal pay to equal time. You spend an hour doing this, you are paid an hour. Why is it that a doctor can charge to me $300 for 5 minutes visit, and and the person who comes to my house to clean my house is paid $8 an hour? So there are major questions that we can only hope that will continue changing. And I'm not waiting how many years? but really go into what is our perspective of what is fair. So helping any woman in individually to increase her skills will make a difference in her lifetime and for her children.
I'm going to answer your question in two ways. I would say one of them is that I think that what we find in our research that I presented, and also what we find in research about abortion more broadly, is that women have made their decisions already by the time they present for care. So I think that women are already able to make decisions, certainly about whether or not to continue a pregnancy or have an abortion. We see that across the board. And then I would also say we have research about what the effects are of women being unable to have an abortion. And those effects indicate that women are more likely to be in poverty if they are unable to have an abortion. They're less likely to be employed. They're more likely to experience violence. And so I would say all of those factors that occur when women are unable to have an abortion, when that is what they want in terms of the pregnancy, those may affect their ability to participate in society more fully.
Well, I'm going to start by absolutely agreeing with what Teresa pointed out, that having an income changes the dynamic in the home, and that underscores the importance of policies to keep women in the workforce. Certainly there are changes happening in the caregiving roles in the household, greater shared responsibility, but given that women still hold the greatest proportion of caregiving in the home, policies to keep them in working, like paid time off, real comprehensive childcare subsidies and expanded health care and maternal leave, so choices don't have to be made whether to call in sick or quit a job when a child is sick, or elder care, which we haven't even brought up, but that certainly falls greater on women. And I come back to my assertion that, and it's not just my assertion, but greater women's political participation, getting more women to run, getting more women in political office will also change the dynamic of seeing women in leadership, but also increase the chances of those policies getting proposed, passed, and implemented.
What I would say is care work, as Susan, Sharon and Teresa have pointed out, care work is the elephant in the room. And we have, social reproduction depends on a group of people performing care work, whether elderly, children, or disabled and ill people. And we have to make sure women are not the sole people who bear the costs of social reproduction. And so we have to have policies that help women, support women and, of course, families in general to make sure that they remain in the workforce if they want to, and they are able to make a decent living based on paid work without sacrificing care
activities. And so as a voting public, concerned voting public, we have to vote in office, locally, nationally, folks who are addressing this central problem and making sure that the costs of care are not privatized but are shared socially.
All right, we have time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Ella Myers. I'm faculty here in political science and gender studies. Thank you very much for the panel. It was great. This question is actually for Sarah Roberts. So I was intrigued. We heard that one of your research interests was trying to develop a genuinely sort of public health approach to abortion provision. And given the degree to which the sort of discourse of women's health has been co-opted by anti-abortion activists, right, in pursuit of these very restrictions that you were cataloging, I just wonder if you have any ideas about sort of in terms of public discourse and sort of our political sphere, how to kind of push a conversation in the direction that you were sort of hinting at, given that that whole language of women's health has been sort of hijacked for other ends?
That's a great question. So I think that what has been intriguing to me is that in terms of the abortion, among abortion rights advocates, the ways in which public health language and arguments are used is very much about how, you know, having abortion be illegal means that it's unsafe. And that seems to be like most of the way in which that argument has been developed. But historically, we've been actually trying to look and see what are the different aspects if we were going to have a genuine public health approach to abortion. And so we've gone about that in two ways. One of them is that we did a literature search and found 200-something articles that alluded to or specified a public health approach to abortion, and so we've gone through and cataloged those. And then we've also taken a public health framework that is used to guide services in terms of public health. It's the 10 essential public health services that say what health departments at local, state, and even the federal level should be doing about a variety of issues. And we've sorted all of those factors that we identified through the literature into those 10 essential services and have added on a few others. But we're really trying to use that to say, you know, our conversation now focuses on health and safety aspects of regulating abortion, focuses on mental health outcomes of abortion. But really, if you look historically, we've also focused on how do we build a service system that actually facilitates women's entry to care? How do we provide, you know, ensure a trained workforce, but using similar mechanisms to how it's done for other healthcare provision? How do we provide education that's accurate about the safety of abortion and making sure that we're engaging groups in addressing problems when they do occur? So in cases that people may be familiar with, like in Pennsylvania and Maryland, where there are some, I would say, rogue abortion providers, working together to come up with community responses to those and actually making sure that the laws are enforced against the people who are really breaking the law, as opposed to the abortion providers who are providing really high quality care.
Excellent. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this forum. Please join me in thanking our panel.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thanks for listening. Thank you.